Hey everyone, it's Sid Evans, Editor-in-Chief of Southern Living. We're taking a quick break, but I wanted to reshare a conversation that I had with the multi-talented actress, singer, songwriter, podcaster, newspaper publisher, and now author, Bethany Joy Lentz. Her new memoir, Dinner for Vampires, will be out October 22nd, and she'll also be joining us for Illumination Charleston, our kickoff to the holidays in Charleston, South Carolina on December 6th and 7th. Make sure to come back next week for my interview with the restaurateur, chef, author, and sister of the legendary musician Jimmy Buffett, Lucy Buffett. We'll see you then. Welcome to Biscuits and Jam from Southern Living. I'm your host, Sid Evans. And today I'm talking with someone who's best known as an actress, but lately she's been stepping out as a singer, songwriter, podcaster, and newspaper publisher. Bethany Joy Lentz was born in Florida and grew up in Texas, which is where she first got involved in the performing arts, carrying on a tradition she inherited from her grandparents. Her family eventually headed to New Jersey, where her southernness drew the wrong kind of attention from some of the girls in her class, but she made it through the experience and eventually landed on the hit TV show One Tree Hill. Now Joy is living in Nashville, writing and performing music, editing a publication called Modern Vintage, and hosting a podcast with her One Tree Hill co-stars called Drama Queens. If that's not enough, she's starring in the new Hallmark original movie, A Biltmore Christmas, which is based on a trip back in time to the famous North Carolina estate. We'll talk about all that, plus the strange and frightening years she spent with a cult, and why she's writing a book about it on this week's Biscuits and Jam. Joy Lentz, welcome to Biscuits and Jam.
Thanks so much. Oh, it's so nice to be here.
Where am I reaching you right now?
I'm in Nashville. Moved here about a year ago with my daughter from LA. And I love it. I mean, I'm a Jersey girl. I grew up in Texas and New Jersey, so it's a lot more my speed being over here. I'm really happy.
Yeah, tell me about that. I mean, the last time I saw you was at our Idea House near Franklin. How's your new home treating you?
It's so lovely. One of the best ways I can use to describe it is that my daughter, who is 12, we've been here a year now, and every time we leave a coffee shop or, you know, the mall, she just turns to me so frequently and says, "Everybody's so nice here." Welcome to Southern hospitality, kid.
Well, that's got to make you feel good that she feels comfortable.
It really does. Her age, we actually moved from Texas to New Jersey to my father's childhood home, if you can imagine what that must have been like for him. And his mother, my grandma, had passed away and the house was available and he had a job offer up in New Jersey. So we left Texas, left Dallas, and moved, and I tell you, those Jersey girls ate me for lunch. They were merciless. Here I was, my blonde hair, my white buck teeth, and my big Texas accent, and it was the worst year of my life. The sixth grade was absolutely the worst, and it got so bad that I used to go into the nurse's office and get a little Dixie cup and go into the bathroom in her office and fill the Dixie cup with water and then make sounds like I was vomiting over the toilet and then throw the Dixie cup full of water into the toilet so she would think that I was, you know, the actor in me really coming out.
Oh my gosh.
Just so that she would send me home because I just couldn't handle how awful they were. And so I have this trauma in my bones and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm moving my daughter across the country. Another kind of culture shock. How is this going to go? It was this really scary thing to do. But I tell you, everybody's so lovely. She's great. Her school's great. The kids are great. The teachers are great. And we're in a culture now with very anti-bully. So that's also incredibly helpful. And yeah, she's doing wonderfully, and so am I. I have a lot of friends here. I have more friends here than I did in 10 years in L.A. It's amazing.
That's great. I hear that all the time about people moving to Nashville. It's just a welcoming place, and there's a lot of transplants and people, you know, moving there. And so I think people just kind of, you know, I don't know. They just sort of open their door and let you right in.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the culture here.
Well, tell me a little bit about Texas. You were born in Florida, right?
Hollywood, Florida.
And then you moved to Texas when?
We moved when I was 3 or 4. I don't remember. But I do remember sitting in the back seat of that car, the long car ride. We had an Oldsmobile, my parents tell me. And I remember just staring out the window for hours and hours and hours. I had a little doll that you pulled the string on its back and it sang. And I remember the song of the doll. And I also remember us pulling into a gas station, and I remember the red brick wall in front of me. And my doll went, clap your hands, all you people, shout unto God with a voice of triumph. Clap your hands, all you people, shout unto God with a voice of praise. Hosanna, Hosanna, na, 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 na. Okay, so the doll's doing this for, I'm sure, 3 hours straight. And my dad finally just, I remember pulling into the gas station. My dad gets out of the car, reaches in the back seat, takes a doll out of my hands, puts it in the trunk, and goes in and gets snacks.
I thought you were going to say you put it in the trash can.
No, just in the trunk.
Okay, yeah.
He's not cruel.
He had had enough.
Yeah, he had definitely had enough. So that's when we moved. And we moved to, I believe, DeSoto, Texas first. And then we were in Arlington. And then we were in Bedford. Moved around.
So do you kind of think of yourself as a Texas girl, or some part of you as a Texas girl?
Totally. I have a very dual identity in many ways with when I'm in Texas and when I'm in the South in general. I mean, you know, I spent 10 years in North Carolina filming a TV show that I can't talk about right now, but the South is so in my bones. And so much of that came from growing up in Texas around the country music and the football and the manners and calling adults by their last names and Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so. And then I have this other side of my personality that is, I mean, I joke, it's like I have the Southern optimism, but the Jersey, something is going to happen.
The New Jersey cynicism.
Yeah, but I do. I feel so connected to the South, the humidity, the way people listen to each other. It's like everybody really cares about getting to know the person that they're talking to. And it's so much less transactional than a lot of other cultures. And I really appreciate that.
What's the town that really stands out the most? Is it DeSoto? Is it Arlington? Or is it a mix of all of them?
I do have most of my memories in, well, I would say Arlington, because there was a little place there called CATS, Creative Arts Theater School. Hmm. I spent every day after school there, couldn't wait to get out of school to go and work on my tap classes and my musical theater classes and do work on whatever play we were doing. And I did that for several years until I started doing regional theater in Texas. And my neighbor, we were in a duplex, and I remember a lot of memories there just late at night crawling out of my bedroom window on the roof and crawling over to my neighbor's bedroom, because she also was my age. And so we shared these opposite wall bedrooms in this duplex. And I would crawl over there after my parents thought I was in bed, and we would just sit up in her room late at night and talk and laugh and like be kids.
I mean, that sounds like something out of a movie. I can picture it.
Totally. Yes. Like crawling on the roof in the middle of the night. Oh my God, my mother would have had a heart attack. But yeah, there's that. And then Bedford was where it started to get tough, because I was fourth, fifth, sixth grade and the hormones are kicking in and it's all the drama. And that was tough. And my parents split up at that time. They got back together later, but yeah, there was a lot of drama those years. But I think the fondest memories that I have of Texas were in Arlington. I did love it there.
What did your parents do for a living that had you moving around so much?
Well, it actually bizarrely wasn't their jobs that moved them, or what, like one specific profession. I mean, my mom is an entrepreneur. She's, as long as I've known her, started businesses and sold them off or jumped into, you know, at one point we had a room full of phones.
As a business?
As a business. She bought a bulk of these phones with the coily cords, and there were boxes and boxes and boxes of these beige phones, and they were business phones so that you would answer them. And I guess maybe there was a shoulder rest on them, and it had all these cool gadgets on the phone. And so she would go around selling phones. She also sold art.
This sounds like Better Call Saul.
She was at one point the executive assistant to the president of Word Music Publishing in Dallas. And my father was a mental health counselor, drug and alcohol rehab counselor, and also an English teacher at one point, and a history, journalism, and Bible teacher, kind of bouncing around there at a high school in Texas. And they had all kinds of odd jobs. I think it was just, they were so young, Sid. They got married at 20 and 22. Mm. And I came along right when my mom was 22. And I mean, in that day and age, like, they had both just gone to Bible college. I think they were like, what do we do?
Let's move. Sure. Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, let's go figure out what we're going to do. So, yeah.
So, Joy, I always talk about food a little bit on this podcast. Who was the cook in your family and what were they kind of known for?
Mama. Mother was always the cook. She loved food. In fact, one of the businesses that she started was meal prep for extraordinarily wealthy people. And to give you the juxtaposition, we lived in a town called Waldwick, New Jersey, and it was directly off of the highway. I mean, my across the street view was the highway. Anyway, we were very, very low income. They were just working hard to do what they could. And one of the businesses my mom started was she would drive after school into these unbelievable neighborhoods. I just couldn't believe these homes. And then we would go in and there were these beautiful, well put together women who were, oh, hello. And you know, one of them, I remember this British woman once with all her plastic surgery. And she was so sweet though. And she had a daughter who had Pearl Jam posters all over her bedroom. And I just was amazed that people lived like this. And my mom would go and we'd spend 3-4 hours there. I'd do my homework and she'd cook her ass off and store all of the meals in their freezer for the next week. And then we'd be back again on Monday.
Wow.
So she was definitely the cook. I had all kinds of weird lunches. Some of them were great. Some of them I traded off for a bologna sandwich, but I ate very well growing up. I can say that.
So what were some of her specialties? I mean, what's something that you loved? Like when you think, I wish I could have this right now.
She made a great corned beef hash.
Okay.
And she used to make these couscous and feta cakes. And this is before couscous was a thing. You know, I think she had to like import the couscous from somewhere. She had to go to the Israeli market or something. But she made these red pepper feta cheese couscous cakes. They were little flat like crab cakes, but made out of couscous. And I'd open up my lunchbox and couscous cakes greeting me. But I did love them. I did.
Yeah, but your friends were probably like, you know, that Joy has got some weird stuff in her lunchbox as they're, you know, eating their peanut butter and jelly. Yeah.
Joy was weird all around. I don't think it was too much of a shock.
What about grandparents? Was there a grandparent who was an especially good cook or who you were close to?
I've never asked my parents about cooking with how they grew up in that regard. Although, now that we're talking about it, I feel like my grandma Marge, my mom's mother, she has a crazy story too. I mean, Reader's Digest version, she grew up a really, really, really wealthy family, Connecticut, Greenwich. Father gambled away all the money and they lost everything and all the kids separated and it was crazy. And then she married my grandfather, who I never knew because he passed, I think, the year that I was born. But during their lifetime, she had 4 kids and he also had a gambling problem and they lost lots of money and the kids had to go live in other places. Like, isn't that bizarre how generational things
yes.
will follow? All the habits that we form, all the things that we subconsciously think are normal or allow ourselves to engage in. I mean, it's amazing to me. But I do remember my mom's mom, my grandma Marge, Nanny, having recipe boxes. She had a lot of recipe boxes around full of handwritten cards of recipes. And I'm sure my mother has those now. I'll have to find out where they are.
Yeah, you need to make sure you hang on to those.
Yes, I'm going to text her as soon as we get done with this so I can not forget that. And then my dad's side. So grandpa and grandma were introduced by Joshua Logan, who is a legendary theater director on Broadway in the 40s. South Pacific, Wish You Were Here, all these amazing shows. My grandpa was on Broadway in these shows and also was a stage manager.
Oh, this is starting to make sense.
Yeah, so they met there. Joshua introduced them and then they split when my dad was 6. And my grandmother, his mom, was just a single mom raising him and his sister for many years. So I don't know if she spent a lot of time cooking or if it was a lot of sort of TV dinner meals. Mm. I have to ask my dad.
But it sounds like some of the acting, the performing is in the blood.
For sure.
Yeah.
Even my grandma's mother, Julia, I believe, left home at 19 to go join the circus. And that would have been 1921, maybe.
Well, you sort of did a modern version of that, I guess.
Yeah, I did. I joke all the time. I'm in the circus. I mean, that's just what our lives are, you know. I mean, it's crazy. So much traveling.
Well, I want to ask you about another town that had a big impact on you and really was kind of another place that you grew up, and that's Wilmington.
Yeah. How much time have you spent there, Sid? Have you been?
Hardly any, just passing through.
Okay, so you haven't really engaged with the town, like wandered around the streets for a long time.
No, I mean, I know it as a magazine editor because we've written about it a number of times, and I know people from there, but no, I haven't really spent time there. But you were there for, what, 10 years?
10 years, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about Wilmington and what is special about it to you, what's magical about it to you, what comes to mind?
The first thing I remember when I got to Wilmington, I got off the plane and it was a sauna. It was so hot outside, but I loved it. I love the humidity. I have curly hair, so it makes me happy, and Mediterranean skin, and I just thrive with that. So it felt great. And then as we started driving through the town, the Spanish moss that was hanging everywhere, it looked like we were in a fairy tale. I couldn't believe how beautiful it was. And you smell the salt right there. And you know, the Atlantic is always so warm. And so anytime we would go to the beach, even if it was November, the water was still like tepid. It wasn't bad. The people were, again, that southern way of welcoming you in. They were all so happy to have us there, employing people and bringing more energy, new energy to the town. The streets were lit up in a really cozy way. This was at a time when a lot of the other shows on TV were very genre-based, and there wasn't a lot happening that was just kids like feeling their feelings. And so I think there was a simplicity to life there that we all embraced because we were all just living the same life that we were living on camera, off camera. It was simple and a little dramatic because we were in our 20s and really, really, really beautiful.
I mean, the other teen shows that I think of kind of a little more money and glitz and all the kids are really rich and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Or there's supernatural things and vampires and superheroes. And I mean, we love all those shows, but yeah, ours kind of stood alone in that way. It was a great time.
So what about just some of your favorite haunts in that town? What were some of your favorite places to go?
It breaks my heart that Deluxe is closed. There's a restaurant called Deluxe that really was our home away from home because they made a great steak. There was a server there who served us for 10 years. He was a professional server. Like, this guy, they just don't make them like this anymore. He really loved serving people, and he would talk to you about the menu. And when he would explain what was on the menu, you felt like you were there catching the fish with the fishermen, and then like in the kitchen with the chef with the olive oil and the white wine and the crushed salt and black pepper combined with the chili sauce. And I mean, whatever. It was just the luxury to go there. And so because we were all on a TV show, we were all like, oh, great, let's just spend our money on great food all the time, which we did. We filled that place up all the time. It was great. So Deluxe was awesome, but it's closed now, and I don't know what's in that space. But there are other staples that we loved. The Dixie Grill. Mm. That's where you go after you wake up after a long night. That's the hangover spot before you have to go into work in the morning. There was a little place on the river called Le Catalan, the French place. I had many a glass of wine there sitting out and looking at the Cape Fear. Spent a lot of time writing in my journals and in Airlie Gardens, Blue Water Grill. And there was a little Italian place on Carolina Beach. I think they made fresh pasta. It was so good.
Do you miss Wilmington?
Yeah, I miss it all the time. And we go back for conventions and things, and I get a chance to jump back into some of those spots. I see a lot of familiar faces and a lot of unfamiliar. I mean, the town has really grown. It's gone through its own boom, and it seems like it's doing really well, which is so nice to see. But it's one thing about getting older, you know, going back to places that you knew when you were a kid and seeing how things change. It's so bittersweet. I don't know if you feel that way. I mean, you've traveled so much in your life. Have you experienced that?
Yeah, it can be hard. I mean, you know, we spent a lot of years in Charleston, and Charleston's a very different place now than it was 10 years ago. But of course, you know, places do change and they evolve, and that's just part of life. But some things you just don't want to change, you know?
I know. I feel like there's these places that I preserve in my mind, and they feel like they're mine. I know they're not mine, but it feels a little bit like, Oh, this is my special spot. Don't ruin it.
Don't come in
with your cute skateboard shop. Yeah. Like that was a flower shop before. I want my flowers. I don't skateboard.
Joy, I want to ask you about your faith, which is something that you've talked about over the years, and it's very much a part of who you are. And I'm just wondering, was the church a part of your life when you were growing up?
It sure was. Yeah. I grew up non-denominational. My grandmother, Marge, was raised Anglican or Catholic, one of the two. Very strict, typical 1930s, 40s upbringing in that faith. And then when life really kicked her butt, she decided to go find out who God is. And so she went to every religion, every church. She just dragged the kids. My mom tells me these memories she has of just being taken to temples and mosques and Christian church cathedrals
really,
and
like,
little churches
it all.
In the everything. And she landed on Christianity. She was a Lutheran for many years. Eventually she converted to Messianic Judaism as a practice. What my mother and her sister ended up really growing up in was Lutheranism and this exposure to Messianic Judaism. And then my mom went to Bible college. That's where she met my dad. And they raised me in a non-denominational environment. And so we visited lots of different denominations, but I think we always landed at this typical American evangelical non-denominational space. And so that was my upbringing.
But you were always going to church somewhere, whether you were in Texas or in New Jersey, or did that even continue when you were in Wilmington?
No, everywhere. My parents really prioritized that. And I have to say, it's one of the things they really did right was instilling in me the confidence to have my own relationship with God. I wasn't doing it perfectly. They weren't doing it perfectly. The church was never going to do it perfectly because the church is made up of human beings and we're all imperfect. But in spite of the fact that we bounced around church to church and we were living in different places and it was hard to really dig into a community because we never knew when we were going to get up and go, I did really feel like Jesus was my best friend growing up, aside from my Cocker Spaniel. And I did really have this sense of not being alone, even though I was an only child and didn't have a ton of friends. And it made a huge difference in my life. Before Wilmington, I moved out to New York on my own and lived there for several years. And I went off and on to Redeemer Prez. And that's where I got to know Tim Keller's ministry. And I was just really enthralled with the idea that my faith didn't have to just be a thing that's all feelings and coffee in the lobby and everybody smiling and feeling good or pretending to feel good, which is what I experienced a lot of in the evangelical church. Going and being a part of that Redeemer Presbyterian community, even though I was 19, 20, I was sort of like toe in, toe out. I was there sometimes and not, but I was enthralled with the idea that faith could be intellectually satisfying, that there was actually a space where I could really use my brain to the fullest capacity and that God wasn't afraid of me asking questions, deep, smart, intelligent, thoughtful, pressing questions about science and faith. And I learned that from listening to Tim Keller. And so his ministry stuck with me for a long time. I moved to Wilmington. I did visit Port City Church. I liked that a lot. And that speaker also felt very cerebral, which I appreciated. But I also took a detour and has been in the press. I had the cult experience for 10 years. So that was happening while I was also in tandem in Wilmington. And so I didn't really sew into a church community in Wilmington, though I wish I had, because I sure would have saved myself a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I saw you talking about that and read some of the things that you said. And it sounds like you did go through a pretty dark time for a long time.
Yeah.
Did your friends on the show kind of help you out of that? Or was it something that you really kind of had to emerge from on your own?
Yeah, what they did help with, I think, was just by their sheer presence and professionalism and kindness, especially the older cast. We know now, being older, and we look at people in their 20s and the decisions they're making and the attitudes they have about things sometimes, and I think we have more grace for them because we know what we were like when we were 20 and the way that we saw the world. And you kind of go, oh, the kids are going to be all right, you know. And I think they saw that in me and their confidence in my ability. They knew I was a smart person. I was a good actor. You can't be a good actor without being smart. You can't dissect a script without being able to assess things. But I had a big blind spot in my life, and everybody does. And mine was something that I was going to have to work out on my own. But in the meantime, I feel like a lot of the people there, whether conscious or subconsciously, knew that just their presence and being an encouragement and letting me know that they still loved and cared about me in spite of the fact that I was a little weird, that made a big difference. It made me feel like there was a safety when it came time for me to leave that group. I did still feel like there were many open arms, and that felt really, really good, and it was very helpful.
Mm. I know you're writing a book about this experience, or at least this is part of the book. What's your hope or goal in sharing that story?
My goal really is that I just want people to know that they're not alone and that there is life after trauma. It was 10 years of pretty intense mental, spiritual, financial abuse. And when you're that young, you're rewiring your brain. Those electrical neural pathways are forming. And so you get out of that and it's like, I need to be a new person, but I have all these old patterns and ways of thinking. And it can feel so overwhelming to come out of that and feel like, I don't even know where to start. I'm back at square one. And there's so much shame attached to that. And then so many people that don't understand, they hear the word cult or they think spiritual abuse. And that sounds real hippy dippy, but it is very real, and people experience it not just on a group level, but one-on-one relationships with a partner or sometimes with family members. It's insidious, and it exists not just in the big bad places that get all the attention, like cults. And so I want to create a space that feels safe and feels like people can go and find out about some crazy stuff, but also you're going to be able to relate and feel like if you come across the people who are predators in this space, that you're going to recognize it. You'll have tools to avoid getting into those traps. If you're already in that trap and you don't know how to get out, maybe this will help inspire you and give you some ideas to be able to know what's normal and what's not normal, how to have boundaries, how to recognize it. I'm kind of packing it all in, and I'm just hoping that it's helpful.
Well, I hope you're nearing the finish line on that project, and I know a lot of people are going to be excited to read it. Well, Joy, I could talk to you all day. I've got more questions, but I'm just going to leave you with one more. What does it mean to you to be Southern?
Slowing down, which I think is so underrated and so valuable. When you slow down, you listen more, you notice more, you hear more, you can create more, you think about more, you have more patience. You have more time. And it's something that is so valuable to me in my life right now, and I think always has been. Yeah, slowing down.
Easier said than done sometimes.
Amen, brother. I know.
Joy Lenz, thanks so much for being on Biscuits and Jam.
I'm so glad you had me. Thank you for inviting me. It was great talking with you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Joy Lenz. Southern Living is based in Birmingham, Alabama. Be sure to follow Biscuits and Jam on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And we'd love your feedback. If you could rate this podcast and leave us a review, we'd really appreciate it. You can also find us online at southernliving.com/biscuitsandjam. Our theme song is by Sean Watkins of Nickel Creek.